Southern Arizona. We're sitting at a kitchen table centered right alongside a window overlooking the desert in one of those infamous ranch-style houses. This is the desert, but not the commercialized nouveau Western desert. It's the real desert in its unbridled, unrelenting glory. As always, tea and cookies are laid out in a pseudo-minimalist fashion. I'm sitting across from Lucien Dieter, a student at nearby Arizona State University, and we're about to discuss White Noise by Don DeLillo. It's at the heart of the postmodern genre. Hello and welcome to Didion, Hawthorne, and the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. So I wanted to ask you first about your initial thoughts on the book and why this was your favorite.
I really like this novel because it's in the first person, limited point of view. So we really get to see through the eyes of Jack his shock and horror of a postmodern world and apply it to ourselves and the world we live in now. I remember I was about halfway through the novel, reading it in a locked car in the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport parking garage, when I realized how it's just so realistic.
So like when compared to books like Frankenstein or Madame Bovary, this touched you more as an individual?
Yeah, and it has a different tone than most other books because there's subtle comedy throughout the whole novel, but it's more of a satire and critiquing society and technology.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask you about any other postmodern books that you've read, because I'm obsessed with postmodernism, like Vonnegut, and I kind of never realized that you also liked postmodern.
I like postmodern, like Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five. Mm-hmm. Who did Catch-22?
Joseph Heller.
And Vonnegut's Hocus Pocus. But I think this is like a different flavor of modernism.
Yeah, I agree. This book is one of the poster children of postmodernism. Yeah, especially since it's been researched and discussed so thoroughly.
Yeah. I like it maybe because it's a modern book and it's not a war book, so it's not trying to critique like the 50s war ideals and stuff, but more of the modern and future aspects of society.
But at the same time, it also has some of those war themes in it, like
absolutely,
the second part. Okay, so let's get into some brief history. It was published in 1985, which is the same year as The Handmaid's Tale, and so that was like a huge year for dystopian fiction. 1984 is obviously set in that time period as well. This is Don DeLillo's 8th book, and it's his most well-known, although he has several other books that are super popular. And it also won the U.S. National Book Award for Fiction, which is a really, really prestigious award, and I feel like it doesn't go to postmodernism as much anymore. So the first section, Waves and Radiation, I think that's the most interesting to me. Is literally just a list of the characters and Jack's kind of daily routine. I think we get our first introduction into the supermarket there as well. It's kind of a gold mine for DeLillo, especially when he's bringing up a lot of these postmodern themes.
The first scene of the novel, we get an idea of how commercial this society is, and then we get like underlying issues that will be exploited later by the situations the characters come into.
Isn't the first scene the station wagon migration or whatever?
Yeah.
And it's almost like reading Faulkner for the first time if you've never read this book, because it's like, where am I? What is happening? But at the same time, once you kind of digest it a little and get into it, it's like, oh. Also, Waves and Radiation. I thought this was really interesting, but I was talking to someone about this, and Jack has no character goal or motivation, and this is so different from all of the other books before Don DeLillo, because usually when you read a book, the character has a goal, or they have like some motivation or some need that they need to fulfill in the totality of the novel, but Jack is literally just living his life and telling us what his life is about. He has no desires whatsoever. But at the same time, even though there is no motivation and this book isn't necessarily intrinsically driven from the outset, it's so, so captivating. I kind of tip my hat to Dawn DeLillo's prose just because it's so riveting.
Yeah, we get our first glimpse into the society there too, how Jack at his university, they wear those giant cloaks as a symbol of status.
I love those, yeah.
And so the author's trying to poke something there. We also get some hints of society, how they react to things when they see that a school had a disaster of some type. I forgot, wasn't it like a chemical spill?
Oh, yeah.
Something.
Chemical spill, yeah.
And it doesn't even scare them. It's so regular by then.
Yeah.
And they're just so numbed that they just, like, don't even acknowledge it.
It almost makes me think of the school shootings and stuff like that. Yeah, there's this great documentary called Tower, and it's about the University of Texas shooting. University of Texas at Houston, I think. And it was the late 60s. And it was just so incredibly alarming. That event really stuck in history. It's kind of like Columbine. Like, everyone knows what that is, and everyone knows what is it called?
Kent State.
Kent State, yeah. It seems like the society is so over it. They don't even remember those choice few spills or shootings or events anymore, which is so alarming, especially for us. Okay, so the second part, the airborne toxic event.
I appreciated that section for the environmental and physiological aspects that this society creates for themselves and how they kind of paint themselves into a corner,
right,
with their own technology and development, and it plays upon their own ignorance. That whole section is really nebulous, and it doesn't even have like separate chapters. It's just one long section. And we see how the characters that were set up in the first chapter or the first section respond to this event, and how they look to others to see what the appropriate response is, and just how quickly a uniform society can crumble.
I was actually wondering about the one long part thing. Do you think that that was a deliberate move on DeLillo's end, or?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Why do you think so?
Maybe it just adds to the chaos and seemingly unstructured idea of that section.
So what happens in the book is that there's this big cloud that they see, and Heinrich, the main character's son's on the roof, and he's like, should I get inside? Jack is
they
totally...
They didn't right away.
Yeah, they didn't. They're totally unfazed by this. And it's the same
part
thing.
Part of the numbness.
Yeah. With, yeah,
they're just eating dinner
spills
with the sirens in the background.
Yeah, literally. Babette, who's, you know, this amazing mother figure and a very careful person, is totally unfazed. So you're thinking, okay, these are sane people for all intents and purposes, and they are not scared at all. While this is going on, all of these side effects are being listed on the radio, and they have three young daughters, and the daughters are just adopting these side effects as
I
they're
love
being
that part. How just like it really does play upon our society, how when people hear things, they tend to adopt them themselves, like taking on an accent in another country or something.
And afterwards, even, there are like deja vu centers. And it almost reminds me, Malcolm Gladwell has this great podcast called Revisionist History, and you should check it out if you have the chance. But one of the episodes recently was about a mass hysteria event in Belgium, I think. And it was the one where they thought that Coca-Cola was poisoning the whole country. And so it was the largest recall in Coca-Cola of all time. It was in the 90s. There was literally nothing wrong with the Coke. But these whole cities at a time would get, like, intense nausea. And, you know, it was literally just in their heads. So, yeah, stuff like that. And I think we don't realize how prevalent those things are.
I also really appreciate how DeLillo captures how society is obsessed with disasters. It seems like everything's planned and controlled, yet when something unplanned like this happens, everyone's obsessed about it. It's kind of grotesque. They're also watching the plane crash on TV. They love disasters so much that they even rehearse evacuation drills where the daughter stands in, is a dead person in their own street.
I want to talk about his disease. The disease he gets by the airborne toxic event.
Mm-hmm.
How deadly do you think it is? And what do you think about the conversation about death that he has when he kind of realizes that he's been infected.
A major theme about this whole novel is a fear of death. And it really comes to a clash and a climax here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we see the measures that they take to keep themselves alive and in touch with their possessions.
Do you want to talk about Dollarama?
Yeah, that was probably my favorite section, just because personally I'm into drug development and research and that kind of thing. Jack is given this gift.
Like, he gives him a gun, right?
Yeah.
I forget where I was reading it from, but it said when a gun is introduced in a story, it needs to be fired. And that's absolutely true in this. You get the gun really early on, and you know pretty much instinctively that it's going to be fired. And so it's just really interesting to see, like, even in postmodernism, they're kind of adhering to this age-old rule of a gun needing to be fired. Also, in this part, Jack reaches a point of absolution. And Jack is this kind of, I don't want to say lazy.
He's easygoing.
Yeah, he's easygoing. He wants to make as little noise as possible. He's very much a routine figure, and he is comfortable and happy in that routine. So breaking it is really hard for him, and what Jack is pushed to do in this last part really speaks to the limits of our individual selves. Okay, now I think we should talk about genre.
Mm-hmm.
So postmodernism, I have a quote from allaboutphilosophy.org, and this is a paraphrase. So it says, postmodernism can't be defined because it is in itself a collection of inabsolutes. Personally, I ultimately think that it's just so hard to define the genre that people have stopped trying. We definitely know that this is a post-World War II category. There's this book called Postmodernism or the Cultural Logic of Late Capitalism. It's by Jameson. It's kind of like an English textbook, if you guys are into that. I haven't read it, so I can't necessarily recommend it, but apparently he has the most direct and adequate definition of postmodernism because he spent his life trying to define it. I also wanted to talk about characters that are purely there for postmodern shock value. I don't know if this is a term that other people use, but I just find that there are characters that are inputted purely for the shock value. I wanted to talk about Tommy Roy Foster, the kid that Heinrich plays chess with, who's a convicted murderer.
Oh, yes, through the mail or something.
Yeah, yes, through mail. And
then, oh, the snake guy.
And Oris Mercator, the snake guy.
Yeah.
Those are both characters just purely for the shock value, because Heinrich is literally a little kid playing chess with a convicted murderer in jail. They're ultimately okay with it, which is something that's so odd to me. And Oris Mercator, his whole impetus in the book is to break the world record for sitting in a cage with poisonous snakes. It's just like, that whole idea is so blasphemous. The only use for him is for shock value.
Yeah, it shows like the obsession with death and fear of death, how it's such a stunt for him to do that.
Oh yeah, that's true. Also, the Treadwells, they're an old couple who get lost in the middle
in
of the
mall.
Book, and then they find them in the mall.
I did some research. That actually happened to people. Like, it just shows how at the height of mall culture and consumerism, how it just was consuming, literally.
Yeah.
Like, they could have died in that mall. Vinny, how she looks into the...
Oh, the dialogue.
The dialogue for Jack.
She
and
has a lot of prevalent lines.
She's interesting.
Too.
Yeah, she kind of sneaks around.
And she's the smartest person in the book by far.
Absolutely.
But she's also the most isolated, which is really interesting because it's almost like DeLillo saying that the people who, you know, are really smart and should be out in society, you know, communicating, are hiding in universities.
She works alone.
Yeah, and so it's almost like a waste because she's able to help Jack in this one instance, but she's kind of like a rubber band. She's only willing to stretch so far for other people. But in reality, the work that she's doing is so helpful for all of us. Okay, also, I wanted to talk about stuff that's unique to this book that kind of breaks from postmodernism. Descriptions. DeLillo's prose is really phenomenal. And just a couple of things. Jack's robe in the first part. Places and scenery throughout the whole novel are really fleshed out in a way that's McCarthy-esque.
Yeah, in this novel, we're not giving exact setting.
Right, and also people. Howard Dunlop, the guy who teaches him German. Now we're going to get into favorite quotes. So hold on to your hats. The first quote that I have is a description. The air was a reverie of wistful summer things. The last languorous day, a chance to go bare-limbed once more, smell the mown clover.
My first quote is by Jack, where he's pondering the existence of death. He thinks that, shouldn't death, I thought, be a swan dive, graceful, white-winged, and smooth, leaving the surface undisturbed?
Okay, next. I'd like to lose interest in myself. Is there any chance of that happening?
Another one by Bet is when she's talking about her daily choices. Either I'm taking something and I don't remember, or either I gain weight or I run up the stadium steps. And then Jack responds by saying, sounds like a boring life. And then Babette ends it by saying, I hope it lasts forever.
Okay, and this quote, I almost got goosebumps when I read it. It's near the end. And this is a transition from, like, the TV said this to a human says this. A woman passing on the street said, a decongestant, an antihistamine, a cough suppressant, a pain reliever. And so it's, like, these, like, really irrelevant lines, but now DeLillo gives it to a human at the end of the book, and it's so chilling.
Do you want to talk about the title?
Yeah.
When I first started reading this, I thought of white noise, like, background
like
sounds. Yeah, to, like, drown out other noises and stuff. And then during the first section, I thought white noise, like, technology, how it's always around us and buzzing and filling our minds. And that, do you want to...
Yeah, so there's a quote at the very end, and it's this, like, incredible build-up section. You don't even realize it's happening until it happens. It's the precise nature of events, things in their actual state. Eventually, he worked himself out of the deep fold, rising nicely, sharply outlined against the busy air, white noise everywhere.
I think it's right after Jack tells Babette that he contracted this toxic chemical that he believes he's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about what they think death is like, and Jack says he thinks it's uniform and white. And then Babette responds to him by saying that she thinks that people are just the sum of their chemical impulses in their brain, which I thought was super interesting.
Yeah, especially since she's so reliant on Dialar working, like, to change her chemicals. And she's so adamant about the fact that she needs to replace all these habits that she has all the time. There's a certain point where you need to stop being so reliant on that.
And just some symbolism of white. Usually that's used to represent purity or something, like in Heart of Darkness.
Oh.
They use the white to represent civilization, like London, which was the height of civilization, contrasted against the dark heart of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So here, whiteness kind of represents the ultimate society and culture, obsessed with light and knowledge and information, and how ultimately it fails them.
Okay, let's talk about relevance. I think we've been touching on it the whole conversation and kind of trying to save it for this. We talked about consumerism already. I think that's pretty fleshed out. Historical significance. It's literally called College on the Hill, okay? America was founded on the City on the Hill principle. It goes all the way back to the colonies. If you took history classes in school, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. But it's even referenced today. It's just so cool to see and how that term was totally flipped on its head and used in this way in the book. The age-old morals and questions and fears that this book really plays on. Especially things like death and like aging and relationships, all those things. And I think ultimately all of those symbols and concepts that we've kind of talked about today can be used as devices to get those harder conversations going. Like if you need to talk to someone about death, you know, you're afraid of death. If you are afraid of talking about money or consumerism or you want to become a minimalist, all these conversations are super relevant in the context of this book. Start talking about these things in any way possible, and I think that, if anything, is going to heal our society.
That's definitely true. You could use that for so many things from this novel.
Finally, related reading, rapid fire. You mentioned Catch-22 by Joseph Heller. God Bless You, Dr. Kevorkian by Kurt Vonnegut. It is great. The Pity of It All by Amos Ellen. It's super interesting, especially since Jack is the professor of Hitler studies. And so if you want to know a little bit more about those tensions and those developments early on, that's a great book to check out. Why I Live at the P.O. by Eudora Welty. The prose just reminds me so much, and I don't know why. I wish I could articulate it better, but it's a short story. It's available online, so just check it out and read it if you have a chance. Hocus Pocus by Kurt Vonnegut. You mentioned this one, too. The main character is super similar to Jack. I love that book. It's one of my favorite Kurt Vonnegut books. Cool. Well, do you have any last comments about the book?
We have like a reliance on privacy, yet this technology dependence kind of is contrary to that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, stay tuned for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. We'll have another special guest, and we'll be chatting about Mother Night by Kurt Vonnegut. Still there? One more thing, then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Acast, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton.